Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host. We are going to be discussing a little bit more details on that so-called silver squeeze at the start of the week, as well as how the precious metals and markets broadly fared throughout another volatile week and another week where investors seem more than willing to move into markets and more risk on assets. I'm happy to report that I am kicking off the show with Axel Merk, Chief Investment Officer at Merk Investments. To keep up to date on Axel's daily thoughts, I recommend following him on Twitter at Axel Merk. Axel, let's start off with that so-called short squeeze in silver. We had some of the Reddit contingent, I guess, jumping on board of that trade, all because, and it's something we've heard before from kind of the precious metals bugs, is that JP Morgan and some other institutions hold a massive short position in silver, and these traders, or maybe some of them, were going after that short position. I feel like this narrative has been muddied a little bit because of the way the futures market works with silver and precious metals, a bit different than some of these lagging stocks that these traders were able to push around in prior weeks. Give us a little summary on the silver short position that we hear about from JP Morgan and what actually happened in your eyes earlier this week.
Sure. Great to be with you. First of all, there's a vast difference between having a quote-unquote squeeze on a fairly thinly traded stock that's heavily shorted versus the silver market, which is, it's not the largest market in the world, but it is substantially larger than any one of those securities are. So let's keep that in mind. You need a lot of actors to get things moving. And then the sort of positioning that many of these corporates have, the financial institutions have, a lot of that is related to helping manage kind of hedging on the production side for corporates and so forth, and not so much on the speculative side. But even there, the producers aren't hedging much in the production these days. And then more importantly, the one thing we do see is on a weekly basis, the CFTC, the Commitment of Traders report. And we monitor this week in, week out, and there was just not an extreme positioning. And similarly, the market makers, right, that short the ETFs and to some degree to make a market, none of those positions were extreme. And so you're starting off with a market that's just far broader, far more liquid. And then what happened, of course, when the retail goes in and starts buying, sure, you can sweep empty the inventory of some coin dealers. I'm sure you can move the market a little bit. But as we've seen, it's all but fizzled out. And the reason is these markets are just too large and the positioning wasn't extreme enough. So this quote-unquote squeeze was more of a hug. Now, all that said, don't get me wrong, the influence of those sort of boards is here to stay, maybe not to the same extreme as we've seen in some of these specific securities, but keep in mind that a lot of these folks, let's say, call them couch potatoes that have gotten a taste of trading, those aren't just 18-year-olds. There are also many, let's call them echo boomers, 30-year-olds. They are starting to get into their higher income years. They have disposable income. And so, and obviously some people got a stimulus check. Now, by all means, many need it for the daily bread. But these are young people that are risk-friendly, and rightfully so, right? I mean, not rightfully so exactly everything that they're doing, but rightfully so that they have a greater risk appetite than many others. And so I think they will contribute to, let's just call it a higher noise to signal ratio in the market going forward.
So Axel, one thing that I found so interesting about that silver squeeze, let's call it, is it does show how much larger the silver market is, because it really worked its way up to a strong resistance level and then could not break through there. It's right where it turned around, right around that $30. Just shows that while these guys could move price in the short term, it was relatively short term, and it was also muted compared to some of the moves we saw in stocks. But let me ask you, in a longer term sense, has there been any damage done to the silver market because of that so-called squeeze? Was there positives that came out of it? Where do you stand?
Well, in some ways, I mean, we've talked for years how these markets are broken. If anything, this showed that these markets actually work, that they are able to shake these things out. Now, that said, if you talk about quote-unquote damage, sure. The folks who rented a coin dealer and bought a coin, maybe there were folks who thought of buying, let's, for the sake of example, they wanted to buy 10 silver coins this year and bought five now to quote-unquote squeeze the market. Will they reallocate their budget and buy more than 10 coins this year, or will there be now a lull because the folks have already bought their coins? At the flip side of that, maybe you got new people who got aware of the silver market and will be more active going forward. I'm very reluctant to say that there's damage, except, of course, fear not, the regulators will probably come crashing down on some of this to investigate things. And I'm not so sure whether only good will come of it. And just on a serious note, briefly, it is illegal to kind of pump up a stock, then sell it, and then see it, then dump it afterwards. And so while a lot of this was just crowdsourced ideas, I'm pretty sure there will be some thought leaders, influencers, as ever we may call them, to have pumped up the stocks, sold them, and then there's going to be media reports on the granny who lost her savings on the way down. Probably going to more happen in these individual securities. But and then some pros got involved in that as well. So we'll have that is where we see the damage that we can potentially damage confidence in these markets because of regulators pointing out some of the misconduct that probably happened along the way, probably just because of the masses of people that got involved. I'm sure some people kind of crossed some red lines along the way somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure they did. And yeah, there are going to be a lot of stories about the poor little retail investor getting sucked into these trades and not being active enough to really follow along and losing a lot of money. It's sad to see, but unfortunately, that seems to be what these markets generate time and time again. Let's talk about the broad precious metals, though, because nearing the end of the week, we were in a corrective phase. You and I are recording this late in the day on Thursday. The markets are closed, but Thursday, bad day for the precious metals. However, you still can make the argument that, especially when it comes to gold, it's still narrowly hanging in this trading range and those lows that we saw at the tail end of last year around 1770. Silver is still right in the middle of its trading range, trading a bit more like an industrial metal, or at least that's supporting it. What's your general take on these precious metals in this now almost 7-month correction that we're in?
Yes, let me just make one more comment on the previous topic. The we talk about coin buying coins versus the futures market. I'm certainly recommending anybody dealing these markets. I just like to remind people of the negative oil prices we have seen. You got to know the small print when you're dealing in anything, really, and especially on derivatives. So you better know what you're doing before you touch any of this. To the broader question that you're raising, we've had reasonably good unemployment numbers. There's a chance that a fairly substantial stimulus might get passed. And while that may be inflationary, the current interpretation of the market appears to be that will get the economy maybe to grow a little bit faster. That means bond yields have been selling, and the big competition, especially the gold, is when you get rewarded in the fixed income market for holding bonds. And so then on a relative basis, gold becomes a little bit less attractive. The most quote-unquote surprising thing is how well precious metals, gold in particular, has been holding up. And I think it is because I always say there are three types of investors. There is the long-term investor who buys for diversification. There's the long-term investor that buys because they think real interest rates will remain very low to negative. And then there's the speculator. And it's the speculator that likes to jump in and out of a trend that maybe we're losing some here because there's short-term a different direction. And in recent weeks, the correlation for the price of gold and equities have been elevated. It's starting to break down. That's a good thing. Obviously, you would prefer to break down with gold going up, right? But the breakdown in itself, I think, is a good thing. But to the fundamental story, gold doesn't pay a yield. So it's just a brick. And that is worthy of holding when the cash in your pocket, at least that's my interpretation, when the cash in your pocket or retains its value or appreciates. Now, you tell me what the odds of that are in the context of all the spending that we have and whatnot. And so we just said bonds are falling, yields are rising. Well, ultimately, these are to a significant extent a reflection of the rate hikes the Federal Reserve will do. And so if you think that the Federal Reserve is going to get all tough, well, by all means, you may want to hide and get out of gold. But if you think that the Federal Reserve is going to keep rates low, if anything, interest rates net of inflation are likely to get more negative. To put this in a different context, we do a lot in the currency space. And whenever a country has higher than expected inflation, often the currency appreciates. You would think it should go down. But the reason why it appreciates, at least on the day of the announcement, is because the perception is, oh, the central bank is going to do the right thing and raise rates. And then guess what? A few weeks later, the currency is weaker because guess what? Central banks has not raised rates. And so these dynamics, they're a tad more complicated. But the short of it is, if you listen to the daily news flow, you're bound to be confused. And the question is whether medium-term price of gold is going to be sustained. And I'm more in the camp that with a Fed that's firmly committed to letting the economy run hot and inflation go high, I think there's a very good chance that the price of gold will be just fine in the medium term.
Okay, that's good to hear. But to your point about rates, though, the market is setting still kind of the long end of the curve. And we've seen the 10-year yield more than double now, just over the last couple months. That is significant. Obviously, that's weighing on the precious metals as well. But how long do you think the Fed will let that happen? Does the Fed have control over the long end? This is noteworthy, even though the 10-year yield is still just barely over 1%.
Exactly. These are ranges, right? And then, yes, it's significant from the low. The question is, how far can this go up? If the last year, I think the last time the Fed kept rates at zero for, I think, 7 years or so, and often the market is ahead of what the the Fed is going to do. And this time around, the Fed is crystal clear that they don't want to do anything. Now, to some extent, it's trying to talk down the yield curve to keep those rates low. But I think it's quite credible that Powell wants to let the economy run hot eventually. I mean, not that that's going to happen this year. And so I think it's a very difficult argument to make that the rates are going to go substantially higher from here anytime soon. Now, you're asking whether the Fed has control over that? Not really. It has control as long as confidence in what the Fed is doing. And one of the reasons the Fed wants to, or at least playing with the idea of moving from buying a certain amount of bonds each month to yield curve control, is because they want to buy less. But the moment they move towards, and by just saying, hey, we're not going to let the yield go up beyond a certain percentage points, the moment they do this, they have a red line in the sand, and that's something the market will at some point be testing. Not anytime soon, probably, but at some point down the road. And so if and when that does happen, well, at the very least, expect more volatility as the dynamics play out.
Sounds like that's going to be a constant this year, is volatility. But we talk a lot about the Fed, and rightfully so. The Fed does hold a lot of power in domestic markets and international markets. And quite frankly, all the central banks are the main ones, the major ones, are reading off the same playbook. Are you seeing any other central banks, though, that you think could start to take the lead and say, we're raising rates, we're not as dovish as we were because of the pandemic, maybe because the pandemic might be getting behind us?
It remains to be seen. New Zealand just had excellent unemployment numbers, for example, but I don't think they're going to hike rates anytime soon. I mean, right now, we've seen really a race to zero around the world in the major countries, right? We had Chinese New Year's coming up, and there are some short-term fluctuations because of liquidity and how they manage the markets. But I don't think anybody is in the mood to raise rates. The Swedish Riksbank, they had negative rates, and they said that it makes no sense. They went back to zero. But the Bank of England just came out and said, dear banks, let's get ready for negative rates. Now, that said, as the announcement was made, the sterling actually appreciated, at least for the day. And the reason there was, they said the banks aren't ready yet for negative rates. And so, if anything, that expectation of lower rates has been taken out of the picture. And so, yeah, the discussions are around how to get more stimulus in place. And in the European Central Bank, they're upset that some of the programs in the various alphabet soups that they have don't have enough of a pickup.
Yeah, they have been. Well, they've been disappointed at what they've been doing, trying to spur some sort of growth in inflation, just like all the other central banks. How are you balancing out when it comes to currency moves? the different central bank policies, because in all fairness, as easy as the US is, it does seem like the ECB is just as easy and can toy with some other policies that the Fed still is resisting.
Well, there's slight difference in the different central banks. The Canadians are probably more reasonable than any of the other ones, but hey, what else is different up north, right? But we are near zero just about anywhere. The broader theme, we had since last March a broader weakening in the dollar. Now, in recent days, the dollar has appreciated, but I do think we've entered a secular bear market for the dollar. And so on a broader basis, we have a global reflationary kind of trend, which means everybody around the world is adding fiscal and monetary stimulus. And when that happens, historically speaking, at least in our analysis, the dollar tends to weaken and the money is going into more of the quote-unquote higher beta currencies. And so I just mentioned the New Zealand dollar, the Australian dollar. Those sort of currencies, or even the Swedish krona, might benefit. Now, on a day we're talking, that's not the case. But that's the trend we are seeing. Emerging markets should also benefit. It's just of that people borrow in US dollars and then make investments in these countries, and that translates to being dollar short. And then if we got a kind of we can get a U-turn, that could be quite abrupt. And then we get a squeeze. We talked beginning about the squeeze, right? And we get the squeeze and a run back to the dollar. And then people realize, well, maybe they don't want to be in the dollar anyway, and it starts all over again. But as these things progress, I do think over the coming years, there's a very good chance that because of that attempt, at least, to reflate the global economy, that the dollar will be in a broader weakening trend, which in turn, of course, is a tailwind to precious metals.
So do you see inflation picking up then in the near term? Let's say first half of this year, even into the second half of this year, is this inflation narrative of rising inflation, is it finally going to take hold in a more sustainable effect?
Well, first of all, inflation isn't just a uniform trend higher. We'll see it in pockets. Second, in the short term, yes, we'll see flare-ups. And that's simply because the year-over-year comparisons, especially as we head into the lockdown months, are just going to be mind-boggling. And so we'll have some price distortions where these indicators will all over the place. That is not, though, the other part of your question, sustainable. That will evolve. The thing I'm more concerned about is what's going to happen if Powell actually gets what he wants. And that's going to happen at some point if we don't have another shock before. I mean, the unemployment rate is going to go lower. We'll let this economy run hot. We'll have shortages left and right. We already have some shortages in some areas. I heard one of the big car manufacturers are stopping productions because they don't get some chips and whatnot. We'll get more shortages at some point. We'll run this economy hot. And then if the Fed really only wants to start raising rates when we are in that situation, we're going to be in a very unstable environment where we'll have high inflation. If they raise rates, the economy is going to plunge. They're scared of a taper trend. They'll do a U-turn. And so that's the sort of environment that I see. It's rather unstable. In the short term, sure, some people will be jumping up and down. Look, I told you inflation is jumping up. But then the next 2 months later, those numbers are going to come down again. So what's going to happen in the coming months, I don't think, is the sustainable part. The sustainable part, if one could call it such, as the instability I see a year and a half, 2-3 years down the road.
All right, interesting. Final comments then. We talk a lot about stimulus. What about U.S. government stimulus? When we got that last stimulus bill, it almost seemed like it took so long that the market didn't even have a reaction to it. The current bill, I guess we can call it the current bill, it seems to be dragging on too. Is there any significance to the markets or to the metals for this upcoming stimulus bill?
Nah, that doesn't matter. You just print the money, it grows on trees. Why would you bother? I mean, obviously, the market is pricing in things, right? And by the time the announcement comes, you might get the sell-off on the news or whatever it may be. I think it's pretty clear, and some of your viewers might disagree, but for me, it's pretty clear, a recovery is on the way. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be smooth. There will be setbacks. But and now we're throwing a boatload of money on this. And so we see the consequences, right? Some of it is we'll see on the trading boards where they don't know what to do with the money, right? And again, I'm not suggesting that there aren't many people that desperately need the money and don't have enough. But and then we've done a lot of damage, but there will be an underlying healing. And the way that the economy recovers, we can argue about that, and that maybe it should be a little different, that we shouldn't have killed so many entrepreneurs and small business, especially restaurants and whatnot. But there will be a recovery somewhere, somehow, and that's going to accelerate as we keep pumping money into this. And so in some ways, these stimulus checks, they are really just touching on a symptom. And sure, the larger the stimulus check is, the bigger the boost in short-term spending. But what matters are the structural things that we're going to deal with. And there, it really depends on the regulatory policy we're going to have. And in the meantime, of course, yes, all this money we're spending is going to stick around somehow. It's just going to create ever more instability if and when the Fed does need to raise rates, because the economy just can't stomach higher rates at that point.
Yeah, that's all what we're waiting for, right? What level are these higher rates actually going to matter to the markets, to the Fed? We don't know that answer, but it has been interesting to see the long end rally as much as it has in terms of yields. Axel, great chatting with you again. I recommend following Axel on Twitter at Axel Merck. It's great having you on the show, Axel. I really appreciate your time, and I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
My pleasure.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Axel Merck. In the next segment, maybe even two segments, I am chatting with Jeff Christian. He is the managing partner over at the CPM Group. Now, Jeff, as I started off this whole show about that silver squeeze earlier on this week, I've talked to you over the years about what these so-called short positions mean for the precious metals, some of these COT reports. You are very good at filtering through a lot of this noise that comes out of the precious metals community that is always bullish. But what actually happened here, Jeff, when it came to the silver squeeze? Was it actually done by, do you think, these retail traders? And when it comes to that short position, what did they misread about the market?
Oh, there's a lot there to unbundle. First off, yeah, obviously the retail guys started the ball rolling, and you know, it's like you talk about collusion. Well, you know, is it putting the stuff in writing. This is like, you know, videotaping yourself trashing the Capitol. Yeah, you know, it's just like, you know, I'm going to collude, which is probably illegal, to try to manipulate the silver price, and I'm going to do it in a public workspace so that you can see, you know, what we're who it is that we're talking about doing. Now, that said, one of the things, and you know, this afternoon, this is Friday morning, this afternoon we'll see the commitment of traders reports. And one of the things that we'll see is that a lot of the buying last Thursday and Friday that took the price up from like $25, $26 up to $30 Monday morning, a lot of that buying was actually institutional investors on the futures and options, you know. But the boys, the Wall Street Bets boys, missed several points. First off, silver's a commodity. It's not a stock. So you do have this SLV and other ETFs, which are SEC-regulated stocks. And those are stocks, and they trade like stocks, and the SEC regulates them. But silver also has futures and options that are CFTC-regulated. And then there's an OTC market, which is unregulated in the United States except by general corporate law. In the UK, the FCA has regulatory authority over the spot and physical and OTC markets. So you had different markets there. So one of the things they misunderstood is that silver is not a stock. And because it's not a stock, in the OTC and futures and options markets, a lot of the shorts that you see, and you know, the OTC shorts are only reported on the COMEX, not the OTC. The OTC shorts are not really reported. The futures and options shorts are reported for the COMEX, and people see these massive shorts. Like, I think the last data that we have right now is the last Tuesday, the 26th of February, 610 million ounces of short, net short open interest by commercial participants, and about 150 million ounces from institutional investor participants in the market. And the conspiracy boys never want to believe that those shorts are actually hedges of physical market positions, but they are. So you look at the 610 million ounces and you say that stuff is actually a hedge of a physical position. The people, the banks and dealers that have those positions are relatively price insensitive, because if the price of silver rises, yes, they're losing money mark to market on their futures and options hedges, but they're making the same amount of money plus some on their physical business that those are hedges of. So if the price of silver goes from 25 to 30, in the OTC market, these guys have assets that are going from 25 to 30 and they're winning, and then their hedge is losing. And that's why you hedge, you know, and that's how you hedge. And that's the issue of hedging. You know, we work for investors, and you try to make money through capital appreciation up and down in the market. But then we also work for commercials who want to hedge. And one of the things that we always say is, you know, investors try to make money, hedgers try not to lose money. And one of the things that goes wrong is when a commercial entity tries to make money off of its hedge. That's not why you're hedging. You're hedging to protect yourself from losing money. Sometimes you make money on a hedge, but that's serendipitous. You know, it's not the reason why you've got that hedge. So you take that 610 million ounces right out. Then you have the institutional investors, which is 150 million ounces or was last week. And yeah, they can lose money by being short the futures and options market. But the short position is a fraction of what the conspiracy people say it is. And it looks like the Wall Street Bets boys thought that the conspiracy theorists knew what they were talking about, and that there were these massive shorts that would be covered. But the massive shorts weren't actually covered. And actually, even with some of the other guys, they dealt a hedge. So as the price moves against them in, say, the options market, they will buy or sell futures. They'll buy futures if they've got, you know, a short position in the options market. They'll buy futures to delta hedge their exposure to rising prices in their options position. So by the time, and you could sit there Thursday and you could say, okay, this can run to $30. But by the time you get to $30, everybody's going to be delta hedged out. And so, yeah, it got a little over $30, and then it came down with a thud, because that's the way the commodities markets work.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for breaking that down. I think it also just shows how much larger this market is, and some of these big players, it does sound like they win either way, but maybe that's why the silver price didn't move as much as some of these underlying stocks. Where does that leave us now, Jeff? Has there been any damage in your eyes done to the silver market? Has it changed any of your short-term analysis or price targets for silver?
Yeah, we're sort of where we were a week ago. and I don't know that it's done damage to the silver market. It might have helped the silver market in that it brought attention to the silver market from generalist investors who would say, hey, you know, what's really going on in silver. But the key point that we keep trying to make with people is that the silver market has been in a positive stance prior to this. You know, you had a 4-day aberration. And if you take those 4 days out, you see a silver market that 2018, 2019 was in really bad shape. Investors were buying very little gold and silver. In fact, a lot of other investors were selling gold and silver because they just gave up the ghost of expecting higher prices. 2020 saw investment demand on a net basis for physical silver triple. Like, more than 100 million ounces were bought by investors in 2020 compared to 27, 36 million ounces in 2018, 2019. So the silver market was getting strong, and the price had gone from like $15, $16 to $23 to $26. And we're back there now. You know, and our expectation is that the silver price will continue to rise modestly in 2021, 2022, more strongly at some other point, that the silver market basically tight. You've got investors coming back into the market because they look at the economic and political world and they say, I think I should own some gold and silver. And that the silver market was in good shape before the Wall Street Bets incident, and it's still in good shape after the Wall Street Bets incident, because the fundamentals and the economic and political factors that drive investment demand remain positive for silver.
Okay, let's talk about some of those positive factors, because right now, silver is at least trading within this range that it's been in for about 6 months, 7 months maybe. Gold, though, has been continuously drifting lower. Recently just held a low that was put in at the tail end of last year. But what are some of these factors that are going to put forth a bit more of a sustainable uptrend after this correction that is getting a bit long in the tooth now?
Yeah, I took some flack from one of my polymath sons the other day because I said, look, interest rates are the single most important factor influencing investment demand for gold and silver. But the correlation between interest rates, changes in real interest rates and changes in gold and silver prices is zero. And he said, Jeff, mathematically, that's nonsense. You know, if it's the most important factor, there should be a high corollary. I said, well, the problem is that it's important in all kinds of ways. You know, the effect of interest rates on investment demand for gold and silver are manifold. And one of the ways that it's important is the effects of interest rates on the stock market, because there's so many people who trade stocks that basis the value, their relative value relative to treasuries, you know, risk-free treasuries, either, you know, bills or 10-year bonds. And so when the interest rate rises, the stock market has to go down in their models. And you'll see that, you know. So you have this indirect thing. Well, you know, higher interest rates should be bad for gold and silver. But the reality is that the first effect is actually positive because it's worse for stocks and it's more immediate for stocks than it is for gold and silver. But in terms of the factors that we're looking at, interest rates are very important. We don't think that interest rates are going to rise sharply. They are rising a little bit, which is a little bit of a headwind for gold and silver, but they remain very low, and they're likely to remain very low. And real interest rates, which are really the, you know, inflation-adjusted drivers, are negative and likely to continue to be negative for some time. If you look at the correlation between and not just the correlation, but the overall relationship between gold and silver prices and real interest rates, you find that it takes like 3% real interest rates before you start seeing a correlated negative impact on gold and silver prices. Investors will wait for 3% real interest rates or higher before they say, that's attractive enough for me to give up my gold and silver and pour my money back into treasuries. Right. No one. I mean, if you have 2% inflation, that's 5% nominal interest rates. I don't know of anyone who's projecting 5% real treasury rates in the near future for the next several years, near or intermediate future. Long run, you can look at the debt that we're building up and say someday the people that have borrowed, that have lent all this money to the U.S. Treasury are going to say, I want a higher interest rate. But that someday is someplace in the distant future that we can't foresee. And those people who have tried have been consistently wrong. You have the gold bugs who keep saying, well, interest rates have got to skyrocket because of the massive deficits and debt being built up by the government. And they're right. The timing is the key. And, you know, people have died of old age waiting for the interest rate market to collapse. There's a great newsletter writer who, in his first issue in 1981, said the treasury market has to collapse. Well, it probably does, you know, but it's been, what, 40 years now? We've gone through some scary times, but it hasn't collapsed. So interest rates are very important. The dollar's strong, stock market, overall economic activity. There's a reduction of political risk or perceived political risk in the United States. The changes in the U.S. government might actually lead to increased international political risk and uncertainties because the government may now try to stand up to Russia, whereas we seem to have had a government that was complicit working for the Russian government prior to last month. So you might see greater political risks on an international basis. We have had this rise of nationalism and nativism and racism and increased tension among governments and among different types of people, and that's not gone away. It's going to continue. So I think those are some of the factors that we're looking at that cause investors to say, yeah, things are better than they were in 2020, but they're not so great that I'm not going to keep buying gold and silver and putting money into gold and silver.
Okay, so that is encouraging, I guess, on a net effect for the precious metals bulls because of the fact that, yeah, we're not seeing gold just drop completely out of bed, and we are still hearing a lot of, even myself, a lot of the generalists I talk to are still saying they like the gold market. They're just waiting for this downtrend, this correction to run its course. But hey, you're also right. Everything in terms of markets is going against the metals right now when it comes to yields, when it comes to the U.S. dollar, although the dollar is falling today on Friday, and the U.S. equity markets. Investors are distracted elsewhere. But you did bring up politics here, and I don't want to get too much into politics in the he said, she said nature, but I do want to talk about how politics can affect the precious metals. We hear a lot about spending programs. That obviously could have an impact on the markets and the metals. But what other aspects of politics, or what are some of the key aspects of politics that you see impacting precious metals most?
Well, I think there's a great dysfunctionality in the U.S. political system. And, you know, it's really on both sides. And if you think about, if you look at various electoral polls and statistics, we have a real bell curve in U.S. political views right now. And the two fringes are exerting much more influence than they ought to statistically, but they're there and they're real. And I think that that creates this political tone of a stalemated government and a divided population. And that those two factors, I think, are important. And they're probably more important in the shorter term or in the intermediate term. So the next, you know, 1 to 3 years, they're probably more important than the deficit spending. The deficit spending and the debt and the lack of political will to fix that are definitely important in the long run. And that's why you're seeing a lot of wealthy investors and others saying, in the long run, I want to have gold and silver as protection against that debt and deficit problem. But in the short term, it's the divisiveness of the population and the political system, the stalemated government, and the lack of political will. You know, it's sad because if you go back to 1947, debt as a percentage of U.S. GDP was like 121%. It's much higher than it is now. And we reduced our debt as a percentage of GDP from 1947 to 1981. And we did that initially with a 91% marginal tax rate. Then Kennedy lowered it to 61%, and everything was cool until 1981 when Reagan and the Congress lowered it too much, and all of a sudden we started seeing debt rise as a percentage of GDP. We don't have to go back to 61% or 91%. If we went back to like 40% as a marginal tax rate, we could start doing a lot of good. And then there are various other things that we could do that would be relatively politically painless to reduce the deficits and actually possibly start paying down the debt. People don't realize we had surpluses for 4 years under Clinton, and we paid down $1 trillion of debt over that 4 year period. So we could, and that was a pretty good time economically, as was the 50s and 60s. Yeah, and it's interesting because you look at the 50s, we had this marginal tax rate that high under Truman, and then we had it under Eisenhower, and there was this political will on the part of the people to say, okay, we have to get our economic house in order. And we have the power to do it right now because the rest of the world's been destroyed. And they kept it that way. And they kept it at 61% or whatever it was for Kennedy and Johnson, but also Nixon and Carter. They had the political will on the part of the people to vote in those guys who were maintaining those high tax rates. And they had the political will on the part of senators, representatives in Congress and the president to say to people, listen, we really have to do this to get our house in order. And all of that went away starting in the 1980s. And it's just gotten worse in the 90s and the aughties. And that's where we are today. So I think that that's one of the bigger issues. Yeah.
So, Jeff, talking about the potential of a higher tax rate here, what about the argument that right now it's a bit of a different world when you not just consider politics, but also loop the Fed into this? Because the Fed does have such a heavy hand in monetary policy. And even though it's not one of their stated goals or even the government's stated goals, there does seem to be a bias behind supporting these markets. There's almost more of a focus on supporting these markets than some of the underlying economic data.
I don't think that the Fed actually is trying to support the stock market. What the Fed is trying to do is stanch the bleeding in the economy. And I do think that that's there. And unfortunately, it's really the fiscal application of the Fed largesse that causes a lot of that money not to go into the real economy, but to go to stock buybacks and stock market purchases. You know, there are some things that I've not understood. You know, in 2008, the Fed started paying banks 25 bip interest fee for excess reserves, and they're still doing that. And I do not understand the logic there, other than that they want to make sure that the banks remain liquid and stable, because if the banks start to fail, then the economy fails. You know, if you look at the U.S. economy econometrically, and you say, well, okay, 2008, 2009, what if the Fed hadn't done all of these terrible things that they're accused of by some people? You would have had a depression. You wouldn't have had 11% unemployment. You would have had 30% unemployment. And you would have had the destruction of industries and job losses. General Motors and Chrysler would not have survived. A lot of other companies and industries would not have survived. You would have gone into a larger period of recession. And I think that that's what the Fed was looking at in 2009, 2010, when it started to do this stuff. The fact that it hasn't been able to unwind is partly the Fed is now held hostage by fiscal policy.
Yeah, that's the key aspect, isn't it? Is that we are hostage. We're all hostage by fiscal policy.
And if you look at it, I mean, going back to Greenspan prior to 2008, Greenspan used to testify on Humphrey Hawkins' testimony twice a year. And he would come up there and say, look, you know, the Fed can stanch the bleeding, but you guys have to get your fiscal house in order. And Cheney famously said at the time, stop talking about it. Deficits don't matter anymore. You know, and that was Greenspan, and then Bernanke, and then Yellen and Powell have all had the same message for the White House and for the Congress. You have to get your fiscal house in order. The monetary policy can only do so much. And there's been no fiscal reform.
So then, Jeff, let's just wrap it up here with a comment on time frame for the end of this correction in gold and silver, and maybe some of your longer term outlooks then. Can you wrap us up with that? How much longer do you think gold will be in this corrective phase?
We think that prices stay relatively modest through the second and possibly the third quarter. We could see some strength at any given time, given the political and economic issues that could pop up and become problematic. But we think that the prices kind of tread water or in this consolidation phase, probably through into the third quarter of this year. And then possibly in the fourth quarter, we might start seeing the prices start to revive.
Okay. Hey, Jeff, great having you on the show. Really appreciate the time that you spent with us on this weekend show. And hey, I look forward to chatting with you probably in another few weeks just to recap maybe where these markets continue to go and what continues to drive, in a broad sense, especially the metals, the precious metals. I hope everybody enjoyed this weekend show. It was, again, a pleasure putting it together. Please, everybody, go back through our website, kereport.com. It was a busy week of daily editorials and company introductions and updates. Please keep all the emails coming, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from all of you. Everybody, have a great rest of your weekend. Jeff, thanks again for your time.
Always a pleasure.